Good morning and welcome to Unifine's fourth quarter 2017 conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. It is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Rafael Borja of iAdvise Corporate Communications. Please go ahead.
Thank you and good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased to welcome you to Unifine Financiera's earnings call. This morning, Unifine's senior management team will discuss the company's fourth quarter 2017 consolidated results for the press release distributed yesterday. If you have not yet received a copy of the earnings release, please contact the investor relations team at Unifine or iAdvise in New York at 212-406-3691 to obtain a copy immediately. Prior to introducing our management, I would like to remind you that forward-looking statements may be made during this conference call. These do not account for economic circumstances, industry conditions, the company's performance, or financial results. As such, the forward-looking statements are based in several assumptions and factors that could change, causing actual results to materially differ from the current expectations. Thus, we ask that you refer to the disclaimer located in the earnings release prior to making any investment decision. We are very pleased to have with us today from Unifine, Mr. Sergio Camacho, Chief Financial Officer, and Mr. David Bernat, Investor Relations Officer. Thank you for your attention. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Sergio Camacho for his presentation. Sir, please go ahead.
Thank you, Rafael. Good morning, everyone, and thank you all for joining us today. Let me start by highlighting that 2017 was once again a great year for Unifine, in spite of having macroeconomic uncertainty in the Mexican and international market as a constant. Cadenet, in part by the ongoing NAFTA negotiations and the threat from the U.S. government to opt out. Notwithstanding this volatile environment, Unifine once again posted record results. We are certain that the Mexican market is strong and the SME sector will remain resilient to such macroeconomic environment. However, Unifine will continue to be prudent as we kept on being a viable and successful company in the long term. Before we proceed to discuss the fourth quarter of 2017 annual results, I would like to comment on the recent relevant transactions in the international market that took place in the past few weeks. On January 25th, the company issued $250 million in subordinated perpetual notes. These notes were oversubscribed more than 7 times. These hybrid bonds helped to significantly enhance the capital structure of the company as the accounting treatment is 100% equity. This results in a pro forma capitalization of around 20%. Following this, and in line with our very prudent risk management approach, on February 9th, the company carried out its fourth offering of senior notes in an amount of $300 million. Particularly with this later transaction, Unifine managed to fulfill in advance its funding requirements for 2018, considering that volatility in the market will be a constant throughout the year, thus allowing the company to continue its growth plan. We would like to highlight that both visions are hedged. Furthermore, as of December 31, 2017, we improved the maturity of our funding mix to 53 months compared to a weighted average maturity of approximately 38 months in our total portfolio. To summarize, the company continues to be extremely focused on protecting its balance sheet and results from any market volatility and international instability. It has also focused on increasing its debt maturity profile to avoid any refinancing risk, always taking into consideration our pillars of prudent and sound financial health. Now, let's proceed to the discussion of our 4Q 2017 financial results. Total revenue increased 57.8% in the fourth quarter to 4.2 billion pesos compared to 2.7 billion pesos in the fourth quarter of 2016. This was comprised of operating lease income growth of 41.5% and 76.4% higher interest income compared to the fourth quarter of 2016. Other lease benefits had significant year-over-year increases. In 2017, total revenues reached 14.3 billion pesos, increasing 50.9% when compared to those obtained in 2016. Interest expense rose 76.7% during the fourth quarter to 1.2 billion pesos, and for 2017, interest expense grew 93.3% to 3.8 billion pesos. This growth is explained by higher financial liabilities that support our growth, in addition to the increase in reference rates of 150 bps throughout the year. At the end of December 31st, we managed to have close to 90% of our outstanding debt remain denominated in fixed rates. While 10% was floating, this is another very good example of the company's prudent risk management. Unifin nominal financial margin rose 37.8% in the quarter and 33.9% for 2017. A healthy 22% margin, which was negatively impacted by the increase in the reference rate. The company's expectation is to continue its trend of repricing asset yields to increase profitability in the upcoming quarters. Administrative and promotional expenses increased 54.2% to 323 million pesos in the fourth quarter, representing 7.7% of total revenue. For 2017, administrative and promotional expenses reached 892 million pesos, an 11.7% increase compared to 2016. This represents a 6.2% of total revenue, a significant improvement when compared to 8.4% in 2016. Said figures bring us to an operating income of 710 million pesos, which represents an 88.9% increase compared to the fourth quarter of 2016. Operating income for 2017 increased 57.3%. Unifin reached a consolidated net income of 491 million pesos during the quarter, which represented a 66.5% increase year over year. For 2017, Unifin net income reached a record of 1.8 billion pesos. This was achieved due to increased operations and higher operating efficiencies, which result in improved profitability. Now, let's move on to our operations. Leasing origination rose 20.1% during 2017, while the operating lease portfolio balance grew 51.6%, reaching 33.4 billion pesos in 2017. Factoring operating volume grew 21.3% at the end of 2017. The factoring portfolio stood at 2.5 billion pesos. Lastly, auto loans experienced a 40.7% rise in operating volume year over year. As of December 31, 2017, auto loan and other loan portfolio balance increased by 10.4%, reaching 5.8 billion pesos. In terms of the balance sheet, the total loan portfolio experienced a 38.3% year over year increase. Total loan portfolio consists of a current net loan portfolio of 5.5 billion pesos, plus leasing account receivables recorded in other account receivable for 4.4 billion pesos, in addition to off balance sheet accounts for 31.8 billion pesos, which are comprised of future rentals of the company operating lease portfolio. As a result, total loan portfolio was 41.6 billion pesos in 2017. The company's past due loan portfolio was 308 million pesos, which considered 39 million pesos from factoring and auto loans, plus 269 million pesos from leasing accounts receivables, which are registered in the other account receivable line. At the end of 2017, our NPL ratio was 0.7%, and the allowance for loan losses coverage was 100%. Total assets for the company increased 31.3%, mainly as a result of the growth in the net portfolio, net fixed assets, and cash equivalents. On the other hand, financial liabilities rose 44.3% due to the growth of year-over-year operations. As aforementioned, Unifin greatly enhanced its debt profile by extending the maturity of the debt to 53 months, but also by fixing the rates of a large part of the debt. Proceeding onward to financial ratios, return on average assets at the close of the fourth quarter was 3.7%, while return on average equity improved to 29.7%. Our record net income figure and the operating asset growth resulted in a solid capitalization ratio of 13.9% at the end of the period. As commented before, the pro forma capitalization after the inclusion of the hybrid bond is close to 20%. Unifin financial leverage ratio was 3.3 times at the close of the fourth quarter, whereas the company's total leverage ratio at the end of the fourth quarter improved to 3.8% compared to 4.4% of the fourth quarter of 2016. This improved leverage of the company is explained by higher profitability as well as the variation in the equity tranche of the hedging derivative registered in the shareholders' equity. This quarter, Unifin's best-class results were driven by our strategies implemented at the beginning of the year. As mentioned in previous conference calls, we continue the process of catching up on our higher origination rates vis-a-vis increased rates in our funding costs. We remain confident in our strategy. It is important to highlight that Unifin approved an average of 40% of its client applications. As expected, our portfolio grew as a result of our excellent track record in delivering high-quality service to our clients, our strong backlog, the opportunities identified by our business intelligence team, and the networking abilities of our more than 200 sales office representatives. We expect this trend to continue in the future, particularly given that the SME sector continues to be greatly underserved. By the end of the fourth quarter, Unifin continues to have a healthy and diversified portfolio. The company has more than 7,000 clients, none of which represents over 1.6% of the total portfolio, and around 80% of our clients have approved credit lines for up to 7.5 million pesos. The client breakdown is spread across varied economic zones and geographic sectors, since it is vital for Unifin to continue having an ample diversification in terms of clients, economic sector, and geographic zones. As a wrap-up, this quarter was successful despite a volatile domestic and global environment caused by political troubles and turmoil in the market. Unifin managed to have a great accomplishment during 2017 and grew across all of its business lines. Our aim is to take advantage of the opportunities in the financial market to ensure that we make the soundest strategic decisions possible for the long-term health and benefit of our company and its shareholders. Notwithstanding the trials 2018 will bring, given the ongoing NAFTA negotiations, domestic political agenda, and international volatility, at Unifin we remain optimistic about the company's future. We will keep working towards greater results supported by the knowledge in our market and our desire and strategy to maximize our platform through constant evolution. Thank you again for your attention, and at this point, we are ready for your questions. Operator, please proceed with the Q&A session.
And at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone telephone. You can remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Once again, star and one on your touchtone phone. We'll take our first question from Jason Mullen with Scotiabank. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thanks for taking my question. My first question is on the perpetual bond issuance. If you can talk about how this will be accounted for in your financial statements, we know that this will count as equity. If you can talk about if this will be accounted for in the equity line, and how the interest costs will be booked. It's my understanding they'll be booked against equity, kind of treated like a dividend payment, and if it will be the interest cost or the full hedging cost booked against book value. And my understanding is only the coupons were hedged from dollar to peso. So if you can talk about the risk of the principal would represent, depending if you want to include the perpetual and equity, about 40% of equity, and if you don't, it would be about 60% of equity would be exposed to U.S. dollar movements. If you can talk about how Unifin views that risk. That's my first question. Thank you.
Sure. Given the accounting criteria, the proceeds of these hybrid bonds are treated 100% as equity, and that's the accounting rule. The payment of the coupons it's accounted as a dividend payment for equity purposes. Therefore, it does not go in the line with the P&L. The hedge that we did was only for the coupon, since we do not have a liability within the balance sheet to hedge. And if we decide to do that, I mean, first of all, we will be having a hedge, let's say a derivative for trading purposes, and we'll have all the impact within the P&L, and that's something that we do not want to have. So we decided to hedge the coupons up to the first non-call date, which will be for 7 years, and that's what we consider to be a very prudent risk management approach.
But and what about the hedging cost for the coupons? Will that be booked similarly in dividends, or will that go through the interest expense line in the P&L?
It's similar to dividends. At the end, all of the accounting effects that the coupons data are recorded within the shareholder's equity.
So this is going to have this cost. I mean, this means that you're going to be running down rather than have the volatility in your P&L. This cost is going to go through equity. So and it's a large portion. There's just the interest expense is something like 4% of equity. So, you know, you're going to be growing, obviously, with earnings, and then you're going to have the negative impact run through book value. Okay, that makes sense. And my second question would be on the latest bond, $300 million. What is the all-in cost? For that you're still you're hedging the principal, correct? What is the total cost?
Yes, that $300 million U.S. dollar bond was fully hedged. In this case, principal and interest, and it has a peso denominated cost of 11.7% fixed.
My understanding is that the costs to hedge are very high today just because of the high differential in interest rates. But so the 11.7 is the full all-in cost, goes from 7.375 to 11.7 with the hedging cost. Okay. And so therefore, I mean, what will, post these offerings, what will your U.S. dollar Is your U.S. dollar debt is going to be over 50%, approximately, I'm guessing, of your debt profile, of your funding?
Yeah, I mean, what is going to happen, I mean, as we speak, of course, the dollar-denominated debt is higher within the liability portfolio. However, as long as we go through the year, that is going to be getting back to the normal levels of 40%, since we are going to be in the market for market securitization. The rationale for accessing and approaching the market with this bond was the increased perception that we had on volatility in the market. And actually, I would like to highlight the pitching response that the company had and the capabilities that Unifin has developed for accessing the market in such a record way. So, we believe that this was the best way to fulfill our funding requirements for the year and be very prudent in risk management. As you know, there's going to be elections in Mexico in July, in addition to NAFTA negotiations. And so we anticipate that volatility in the best interest of our shareholders and our bondholders, actually.
So I understand that. I mean, what I'm just trying to understand better is I get that as a manager, you might not want to have the volatility in the P&L marking to market some kind of hedging instrument, and that you wouldn't want to, I guess, you want it to count as equity, so you're not going to be able to put that through, you're not going to be able to put it through the equity account, but the risk is still there. I mean, even though you're not recognizing it in the P&L, I mean, you have $250 million in exposure, very large portion of Unifin's equity now open to dollar exposure. We may not be seeing it mark to market in the P&L, but that risk exists. So, I mean, wouldn't it be more prudent? I mean, to me, that seems risky that you're taking on risk by not, I get it if you had to go through a trade, you know, through a trading account, kind of hedge that, but that would mitigate, at least we know that you're hedged. And if the currency does get very weak in the current context that, you know, you have limited losses.
Yes, but also we're going to be going through high volatility levels. We consider that not catching the perpetual bond is the right thing to do since we do not have the liability. In the hybrid bond, we have the option to pay it from whatever we want. Therefore, we may want that we start approaching to a non-call date. If we decide that we're going to pay that bond, we may go and start looking for whatever hedging alternative we may find. One say that, if we see from now to 7 years, the proportion of the hybrid bond within the portfolio of Unifin is going to be minimal.
Okay. Thank you very much. And maybe just what about the outlook for 2018 in terms of the pipeline and any other indications of expectations or guidance you can share would be helpful. Thanks.
I mean, we are confident on the perspective for 2018. Our backlog continues to be very robust and on a very healthy number, and we expect that to deliver. Of course, we need to take into consideration whatever volatility or may cause the election and NAFTA, as I have already explained, but we are confident we continue to grow. I'm very confident on the SME sector. That's why, actually, we performed all of our needs for the year, because we want to be prepared and to have whatever we need to have ready to fulfill the demand that we may have.
Thank you very much. Very helpful.
We'll take our next question from Carlos Rivera with Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. Thanks all for the presentation. My first question is related to the other income line. We saw a pretty large number this quarter, $159 million. So just if you could give us a little bit more color there, what is driving this? Is there any element that could be considered non-recurring or just more color on what could we expect going forward for this line? And my second question is related to the change in book value, pretty significant. We saw this quarter almost $1.4 billion positive mark-to-market valuation. I understand it's coming from the hedges for the FX exposure and also a portion from the interest rate. So if you could just give us a little bit more color and a little bit of sense of the sensitivity of this portion to, let's say, 5%, 1%, whatever, how you can calculate it. In terms of the variations either on the FX and rates, because it's going to be a pretty significant change for us to project in book value. And following up on the prior question also now that the $250 million perpetual is also exposed, so that also adds a little bit of a variation to your equity there. So any color on how to project that or think about the equity would help us a lot. Thank you very much.
Yes, let me start with the second question. The hybrid bond, despite whatever the exchange rate is not going to represent any variation within the stockholder's equity. So the only variation that we're going to have there is all the mark-to-market that we have with all of our hedging related to the 144A bond. A very good question is what can be the sensitivity for whatever 10 cents or so on the depreciation of the currency, but it is very, very, very difficult. We have been working very close with our financial advisors, first of all, to find an alternative to reduce volatility within the market market, but more importantly, we try to understand how to model the market market variation. But believe me, it is very, very difficult since you have the variable of the exchange rate, you have the variable on the rate, and also on the curve on the rate and on the curve on the exchange rate, not the price of the spot. So for us, it has been also very, very difficult to model the mark-to-market behavior going forward. Of course, once as long as we go through the years, that value is gonna be zero as long as we go through the maturity. So going forward, if we do not issue any further, let's say, no Mexico debt, that number is going to be reduced quarter over quarter.
Carlos, just one additional consideration regarding the mark-to-market. For rating agency purposes, they give zero away to the mark-to-market valuation of the derivatives for the capitalization. Given that, so what happens is that if the mark-to-market is positive, they give zero away, but also if the mark-to-market is negative, they also give zero away to it. Meaning that this will not affect the outlook on the company or the rating of the company if there is volatility across the equity portion. No?
Okay, so just both questions there before we move to the other question. Can you share with us the book value then as of December that the rating agencies will consider? And on the perpetual, what would be the effect? It was $250 million, to which currency rate is going to be translated into pesos. And using that as a base, what happens if in 3 months from now the peso appreciates or depreciates? Just trying to understand the equity part a little bit better. Thanks.
Yeah, the equity decision that, for example, Fitch will consider 50%, talking about the hybrid bond, will consider 50% of the total issuance as equity, and the Standard & Poor's will consider 33% of the adjusted common equity of the company, which is basically a 50% of the issuance. And actually, the rationale for only issuing $250 million, despite the tremendous demand that we have on the hybrid bond, was that we carried out our analysis and found out that $250 million was the most efficient number on this instrument for equity criteria.
Thank you. We'll go next to Diego Ciccone with Scotiabank. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. I wanted to understand a little bit what's going on with the accounting of leases in the balance sheet. I remember that we used to have leases in the performing loans, and now for some reason it's being moved to other accounts receivable. It's my understanding that you usually book only the accrual for the next 12 months, if I'm not mistaken. Has it changed anyhow, and how can we see exactly what is the lease portion in the balance sheet?
Yeah, I mean, this is only a presentation issue within our balance sheet. We received a recommendation from both, first of all, within the PricewC, which is our audit firm. There was a change within the partner, so now we're being audited by a different partner. And this girl, along with the Mexican Banking Commission, suggested us that we need to classify the portfolio to be even more close to the norms of accounting issued by the Mexican Banking Commission for the non-regulated operating leasing, at the firms, no? Which is our case. But once again, it's only a presentation issue and does not affect any of the results of the company at all.
Okay. So in terms of the NPLs, if I look at the balance sheet right now, I only see the portion of NPLs of the factoring and auto loans. You mentioned that you have 100% coverage of NPLs. Where can I see this extra reserve?
You're going to see that, because everything is included within the other accounts receivable, you have the net in that. But that's why we made the disclosure within our press release, and actually I already did it in the call, on how much was of the NPL or destination for NPL under the leasing business. And once again, we have a full coverage of 100% on that number.
Okay. And if I could just follow up on the hedging question quickly, I don't know if I understood. What would you say a 5% change in FX would do to the mark-to-market of your current debt?
What we said is that we there is no a direct, there is no full, let's say, a perfect correlation on the depreciation of the currency. In the multi-market valuation, you have the spot on the FX, the spot on the reference rate, but also the curve up to 7 years or 8 years, depending on the tenor of the hedge. And depending on how those these curves move, you have the impact on the mark-to-market. In addition, that number is also affected depending on the quarter that you're talking about, if it has already paid coupon or not. So every time that we pay a coupon, the mark-to-market suffers significantly because of the net present value of the flows on the mark-to-market.
Yeah, I understand. I'm trying to isolate the effect of the FX. Sorry, go ahead.
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. I'm just trying to isolate the actual impact of the FX only. Let's say that we consider everything else equal. If FX goes up or down 5%, what would be the impact on your equity?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get back to you. We're going to ask that analysis to be performed by our financial advisors, and they are the experts on this matter. And David, we will return to you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
And our next question comes from Alonso Garcia with Credit Suisse.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking my question. My first question is regarding OPEX. We observed a very significant spike from the third quarter level. So if you could give some color on the reasons for that. And my second question is actually a follow-up on the previous question regarding the 176 million peso gain in the other income line. What was the nature of that gain? And if we consider that as something that will be recurring going forward, or was it more of an extraordinary item? Thank you.
Yes, I mean, The increase, if you see the OPEX third quarter versus fourth quarter, you need to remember that in the third quarter we have an extraordinary positive effect on that line. If we compare the fourth quarter vis-a-vis the fourth quarter, the growth is pretty much in line with the growth of the business. And as a matter of fact, if we see the full year, we improve the OPEX as a percentage of the revenue. Also, so we believe that we're on the right track to make the company more efficient. Regarding the operating income, what is in there? We had an income on a fee received for a low incident rate on our insured assets. If you remember, we have an insured facility, and depending at the end of the year, if we have low incident rate, we receive a dividend or a fee for having that. And that's basically the most important part of that operating income, in addition to some claims related to budget loans from previous years.
Okay, so I guess the main driver was the insurance part of this line, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Do you think that's something that it could be? Of course, will depend on the sinistrality every year. But do you think is something that you can count on every fourth quarter, or is this?
If you see, for example, the growth that we're having in our portfolio, and as long as we are continuing the trend of increasing our insurance facility and allocating more insurance there, I will say that you can consider that to be a current number going forward.
Perfect. Thank you.
And our next question is from Claudia Benavente with Santander. Please go ahead.
Hi. I have two questions. The first one would be regarding your liability position. I understand there's a portion that has been hedged with the derivatives, or in other words, how much that is currently fixed can be changed to variable should rates start decreasing at a faster than expected pace. And my second question is, does it sound a reasonable capital ratio of 15% using Standard & Poor's criteria? And how long do you feel with current growth you can sustain this level of capital? Thank you.
Yes, I mean, on the liability side, we consider to be a very prudent way of managing risk to have currently close to 90% on a fixed rate. We do not anticipate in the short term any reduction on the rate. Therefore, we feel very comfortable with that level. And also, we carried out the latest transaction also to continue improving the maturity on our liability. And getting to the capitalization, the mid-teens that we are forecasting, we believe that as long as we continue with our strategy on catching up the higher origination rate within our revenue line, our profitability is going to be improved. Therefore, the growth on the portfolio, vis-a-vis the growth on the profitability, it's going to be somehow matched, and we are going to be able to maintain the same levels of capitalization for at least 2 to 3 years from now.
Okay, but following up on the first question regarding the funding, I was asking how much can be changed to a variable portion because some of it was hedged with derivatives. Therefore, you can change a portion to a variable liability, and that would benefit in the case interest rates start decreasing, right?
With financial instruments, everything can be swapped to variable rates.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question will come from Chelsea Colon with TIAA Investments.
Hi, and thank you for the call. I just wanted to get a little better understanding of how you're thinking about the capital structure, because when you issued these two bonds recently, including the hybrid, that obviously reduces the securitizations as a percentage of your total funding. But then you mentioned earlier in the call that you plan to issue more securitizations later. So the question for you is, do you look at a ratio such as unencumbered assets to unsecured debt coverage? I know that S&P is very, conscious of that. So I just wanted to kind of understand how you think about the mix of unsecured versus secured debt and what we should see going forward.
What we did with the, for example, with the proceeds on the hybrid bonds, we basically cleaned all of our banking facility lines. And the reason for the latest bond was to extend the maturity, but continue without accessing the banking lines. We are planning to issue another market securitization because it does not account for leverage purposes. But having the option to access the banking line if the markets are not there. So going forward, you can expect to see very similar levels of leverage within our numbers. And of course, we are very close to the criteria that the rating agencies have.
So on a pro forma basis for the recent issuances, where does that ratio stand, the unencumbered assets to unsecured debt coverage?
Give me one sec.
Justin, we'll follow up with that. The pro forma figure, we don't get it right now. I'll make sure to send it right after the call. But it should have improved since we used the proceeds from the insurance to prepay some debt that hasn't come with that. No?
Okay, thank you. And then just one more question. What was the reason for the jump in foreclosed assets in the quarter? What is that related to?
So, I mean, as a natural course of business, we did manage to repossess, let's say, some additional assets that we have from past due accounts receivable from certain clients. So, I do have to be very specific that considering for both assets, these assets do not represent only these assets or assets under lease. Okay? The foreclosed assets mean additional guarantees that we execute from clients that go non-performing. But, I mean, it's a one-off effect. This is not occurring, but it's an additional part of the, it's a natural part of the study.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question is from Javier Cervantes with BCP Securities.
Hi, thank you for the call. Wondering, I've seen that your NPLs have stayed basically flat at 0.7% during the last at least 2 years. How have you managed to grow the portfolio in such a way without taking any hits on the credit quality of the loans?
Sure, Javier. I mean, it's basically the essence of Unifin. To have a very healthy levels of NPL has to do with originating on a very healthy way. We continue to work very, very hard with our credit standards, with our credit scorecard, only originating operating leases, leases or assets that have their own cash flow by itself, assets that are part of a significant part of the SME that we're dealing with. Of course, having in all of our leases the legal depository figure that we have explained in the past and it's a very, very solid legal figure for collecting the assets. So when you continue growing with the same levels of prudence and a very conservative risk management approach, it's why you are capable of keeping and having these very healthy NPL ratio.
Okay, thank you.
We'll take our next question from Gabriel Nobrega with UBS. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. It's actually Frederick DeMeritt from UBS. So let me ask two questions. The first one is a follow-up on the discussion on the perpetual bond and equity. So you mentioned it's treated as equity. I believe you mentioned it's treated as equity by your accountants and by the rating agencies. I wanted to hear your thoughts from a prudential standpoint. Following that issuance of the perpetual bond, you're going to have a large share of your capital coming from hybrids. And so I wanted to hear from you, how do you think about the pure equity base? And is there some kind of a target in terms of equity to assets, not including the hybrids, that you consider internally? I understand the rating agencies look at the all-in capital, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on the equity. And now I'll come back with my second question.
Yes, the accounting, the criteria in the account of the hybrid bond is 100% to be treated as equity. And as I mentioned, the two rating agencies treat them on a different basis. We are, according to our plan, our business plan, we are okay with this vision, and we do not expect to access in the near term on another hybrid bond or so for equity purposes. And the ratio that we are going to be targeting or that we're going to be focused on is to maintain a mid-teen in that arena.
Okay, great. And then the second question, you mentioned a few other questions, you know, the impact on cost of funding from the various issuances you're making in dollar, even though all your business is in pesos. So my question here is, how do you think of margins for this year and next year? What kind of compression are you expecting here?
Actually, we are forecasting margins to be from stable to improvement based on the fact that we have lost the cost of funding, no? And as long as we go through the coming quarters, the proportion of origination within our revenue line carried out in 2017 and now 2016, which have been originated at higher rates, is going to be more relevant. Therefore, the profitability of the company is going to be enhanced. And that's why we are based our model on from stable to improvement on margin.
Fred, just okay. One consideration. Please do remember that margin on a quarter-to-quarter basis or quarter-on-quarter basis can present some volatility given that the company is regularly active in the market. And this, of course, in the short term, within the quarter, has impact. No? If you annualize the margin consideration, that's where we are starting to see a stabilization of margin and probably an improvement, but also considering a 12-month analysis, not just quarter-to-quarter comparison. No?
Okay, I understand this. So we had a decrease, a compression in margins in the fourth quarter, but when we look at the full year of 2017 versus the full year of 2016, we also had a compression. So are you guiding to say that in 2018 we should work with stable margins, or you're expecting that the business is going to deliver stable to slightly up? And if this is the case, then what kind of expansion would you be expecting?
Yes, some stable to improvement, and we may expect a 50 to 100 bits.
Margin. That's great. Thank you. Okay, and you're saying it's mostly because of lower cost of funding?
It is because of the local on the cost of funding and higher origination rates that are going to be within our revenue line.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Our next question is from Jorge Mauro with Fundamenta. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my question. This is regarding, if you take on the P&L, the two lines of other lease benefits and other lease expenses, and you combine them, I've seen that in the last 11 quarters, this was on average 5 million pesos negative, but it came at 225 million positive this quarter. So I'm trying to understand a bit better this line, because if I combine it with the other operating income, if I were to adjust for this, I get to an ROE of 11%. So just trying to understand how recurrent these things are. Thank you.
Hi, Jorge, David speaking. The reason of the calculation on other benefits is none other than the calendarization of assets that get purchased by our clients at the end of each lease. It might present variation given that, for instance, within a quarter we might have an accumulation on contracts that have become due. That were more relevant in terms of peso amount, no, rather than in other quarters. When you actually analyze this effect, the difference between the other benefits to other expenses is 80 million pesos, which we do not consider to be material. No? But then again, it might be because of the calendarization and the difference between book value and the residual value that we carry in some transactions that we close with the client. I think going forward, you should be, for modeling purposes, you should be modeling almost net effect between these two lines, no?
Okay, so these two lines combined should be close to zero going forward.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Sorry, and then the I didn't understand the 176 million on the other operating income net that you mentioned a benefit on some assets. Can you please give us more color on that as well? Because it was pretty significant relative to the last 12 quarters.
I mean, the most important benefit there was Unifin's gains coming from the insurance fee, no, even low incident rate in the insured assets that the company has, no. This is going to represent, like we said before, this is going to be presenting going forward, no, towards the end of the year, given that that's when you make the assessment of how many assets actually presented these incidents, no. And that was the by far the most important effect in this line. Additionally, we also incurred an additional gain coming from the claims or income coming from the collections from previous years. No?
So recoveries, not collections. You had better recoveries than the previous years.
Recoveries. Of past due loan accounts for previous years.
Okay, that's clear. Thank you so much for your answers.
And we'll take our next question from Neha Agarwala with HSBC.
Hi, most of my questions were answered. But just to get clarity on your capitalization ratio, you mentioned that you're comfortable with the current levels, but we note that your current equity to assets is about 14%, and with the perps issue, it goes up to 20%. So in the medium term, what is the level that you want to operate at? Is it closer to 15% or more closer to 20%? Thank you so much.
No, I mean, that number rate is what we consider to be very conservative. Of course, the higher number that we have there is going to be better for us. I mean, we're not going to do anything extraordinary to jeopardize that level. If we can achieve to be on the high teens, I mean, we're going to be there.
Okay, so you would target to be in the high teens range.
I mean, that would be something that we would like to have, but to be more conservative, that's what we are targeting to the market, the mid-team.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll go next to Enrique Mendoza with Actinver. Please go ahead.
Hi. Good morning to everyone. A follow-up regarding the accounting change made from performing loans into account receivables. I just wondering if the change is more related with lease rentals paid in advance by the borrower, or if are more related with commissions collected for the initial granting of operating leases. That's my first question, and if I may, I have another question.
Sorry, Enrique, can you repeat the question, because the line, I mean, we don't hear very well your question. Sorry for that.
Yes. Just a follow-up regarding the accounting change from performing loans into account receivables. Just wondering if the change is more related with lease rentals paid in advance by the borrowers, or if it is more related with commissions collected for the initial granting of operating leases.
No. The third line on the lease business went to the other account receivable. Both the portfolio as well as the estimation on their non-performing loans. Nothing changed. Nothing changed at all.
But the just to better understand the change and how to assess that is it because of you mentioned something about the talks with the banking commission in order to improve the information for investors. Can Can you elaborate more about that?
Sure, yes. I mean, the banking commission, which is more focused over time, does not have a particular criteria on performance that are non-regulated, which is the case of Unifin. So getting into, let's say, a review and getting the new partner within the PricewaterhouseCoopers, they suggested that we need to record the portfolio that is from the leasing and auto loans on the current portfolio and send the leasing portfolio with the estimation on NPLs to other accounts receivable. Just a matter of presentation, and that is more or in line with what a bank presents. And that's it. It's that simple as that.
Okay, okay. Yeah, and on the other hand, talking about the expected further interest margin expansion that you are expecting for 2018, I see further declines in the average leasing price at the end of the year. Are you considering that trend overall in order to expect further margin expansions for 2018?
Well, what we're considering in that expectation is that as long as we roll through the quarters, having increased our origination rate in 2017, 200 bits, and late 2016, a similar number, our revenue line is going to be more profitable. Last year, for example, we have in that our revenue line origination carried out 2017, 16, 15, and 14. The catch-up that we need to carry out is for offsetting the increase on the reference rate on the TA that went up more than 400 bits within a 18-month period of time. Of course, it's taking time, and that's why you see the contraction in the margins on the results of 2017. We're not considering anything different on that based on the proportion that we're going to have in the revenue of origination carried out in 2017, 18, so forth, so on.
Therefore, if I understand correct, we should expect the average leasing price to start to increase in coming quarters.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Next is Uya DiMambro with Federated. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. I apologize, this topic has been discussed a lot already, but I just want to make sure I understand. So as far as your perpetual is concerned, in your accounts, it's accounted as 100% equity. So the exchange rate movements do not matter for that because it always gets converted at the exchange rate that was initially recorded at. So even if you wanted to hedge the principal, you couldn't because that would create additional fluctuations in your balance sheet. And then as far as rating agencies are concerned, they give you 50% equity credit for that perpetual, but again, the exchange rate that they use for the equity and the debt portion never changes. Is that correct?
Julia, you understand it very, very well. Everything that you said is correct. The hybrid bond is considered our company treated 100% equity, and therefore there's no need to. I mean, whatever the exchange rate moves, there's going to be any impact on the shareholders' equity.
And then, as far as rating agencies are concerned, FX movements do not have an impact on the ratios that they look at as far as this hybrid is concerned.
That's correct as well.
Great. So actually having this hybrid in your capital structure benefits your balance sheet because you would be effectively long dollars in a way. Is that right? Because the denominator in your ratio will actually have more dollars in it than your assets.
Can you repeat that?
So I'm saying that it benefits your capital structure because it's dollar capital for you. So when the rating agencies calculate your leverage ratios, they basically that capital never changes as far as FX is concerned. Whereas on the whereas the other parts of the leverage ratio, they do change with FX.
The accounting movement was as simple as this. We received the funds on the hybrid bond, so we have an injection between the capital structure, well, shareholder equity, and on the other hand came up to cash, and the terminated FX rate.
Understood. That's great. Thank you very much.
From one part on equity and another on the part on the assets on the cash and cash equivalent.
Great. Thank you.
And next will be a follow-up from Jason Molan. Please go ahead. Your line's open.
Yes. Hi. I wanted to ask about the NPLs because the non-performing loans, as you report them, at the that have been around the 0.7%. I mean, as you've made clear in your disclosures, that this only includes the missed installment payments and not the outstanding balances of leases. So my question is, and you have disclose some of this to the rating agencies, but can you tell us what would that be, what's been the trend in the fourth quarter of full outstanding balances and installment payments as a percentage of the total? And if you know, you think it makes sense, I think that's that would be the way that that analysts typically look at financial institutions. We know you're not regulated and don't have to do this, but clearly the rating agencies wanted some estimate of this, and I think investors would benefit from it. Is there any plans to put this in your release and track this so we can track it?
No, because in nature, we cannot compare ourselves. We cannot compare that criteria to a traditional bank because we own the asset. We own the asset that is within the lease agreement. Within the bank, they do not own a collateral on a credit line. So that's why they take the full amount on the credit and consider as a non-performing credit in their case. In our case, on a stress test carried out by the rating agencies, they calculate something similar, but in those numbers, they are not considering the value on the assets. So in our case, we consider that the way that we show the NPL is the right way to do it because, once again, we own the assets.
I understand that, and I think it's a very valid point. I just think that you are disclosing that information to the rating agency. Whether you can argue whether you think it's valid or not. I mean, clearly we have other loan segments where when it's a car loan rather than a lease, the banks don't own it, but there is collateral behind it. It's different. I get it. But what would that be? Because you have disclosed that to the rating agency.
It will be on a low single digit number, better than a bank.
So is it? How is the trend?
Considering the value on the asset.
So is the trend on what you've been disclosing improving or deteriorating?
It has maintained at the same healthy level.
Okay. That's helpful. I just think it's helpful. I agree. You're not, well, by definition, you're not a bank. But it is one way to think about delinquency, just the missed payment. I get it that you can
you can recover, you own the asset and you're depreciating a large number, 20% per year. So that is important. But thank you. That's
also
helpful.
Something that is very, very important to clarify, and in addition to what you're saying, we, after the third payment that we did not receive, we stopped recording the income in our P&L. But very, very important, continue with the depreciation of the asset. So we basically have a full coverage of the third rent on the NPL of the third rent and continue taking into the results the depreciation of the assets, which is like a natural reserve on the P&A.
That's very helpful. You know, maybe just for the sake, because there are a lot of questions on the hedging and the implications and the hedging strategy, how should we think? I mean, I guess the perpetual is a different kind of product, but if we think about excluding the perpetual, if we think about your funding in dollars and you're, when you say that you hedge both the principal and interest payments, through the life of that funding method, we shouldn't expect FX and interest rates shouldn't matter, right? The net impact, whether we account for a market to market in one quarter during the life of that product, of that security, if you're hedging exactly, I mean, 100%, then the net impact by the end of at maturity is zero. Is that correct? Or it's too difficult to hedge exactly?
That's correct. The effect on the market is only on accounting perspective. It's not a cash flow impact.
But do you, I mean, like when we see this positive impact this quarter, let's say, in the valuation of the hedging instruments of $1.4 billion, we should think that on the opposite side, there was a loss somewhere. I'm not sure where we see that. Or at least through the period of the product, the impact should be zero if it's hedged. I mean, if it can be hedged exactly.
At maturity, the impact is going to be zero.
Okay. That's what I just want to double check. And that now, of course, when you're holding an open position, and are you entering in treasury operations to kind of move that position around during the quarter, or that there are no positions? It's only to hedge?
The number that we record in our financial statements are the numbers that come from the statement from the counterparties of the hedges.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. And next is also a follow-up from Jorge Mauro. Please go ahead. Your line's open.
Yes. Hello. Just a follow-up. I'm trying to add up the quarters with the years on this line, other lease benefit and other lease expenses, and I'm getting to a difference of 60 million pesos, 59 actually. I mean, can you help me understand? Did you reclassify some revenues into expenses? Because for the net income, I don't see any difference, but I do find these differences on the top line.
Okay, can you please repeat the question?
Yeah, so if I take the other lease benefits, you reported a revenue of $1.11 billion for the year and 557 for the quarter. But if I take that yearly figure and I subtract the last three quarters, the implied would have been 435 instead of the 557 you reported. So there is a difference in this line. And I find that there is another difference in the interest income, and then another one in the other expenses from leasing operation, other lease expenses. The thing, if I combine all these, I'm just taking the annual figure and subtracting the last three quarters, and I see differences is not the same as the quarterly figure of the fourth quarter. So to me, that means that you reclassify something.
Honestly, I don't have that information here with me. We will get back to you with that.
Okay, sure. Thank you.
And it appears we have no further questions at this time. I'll return the floor to you, Sergio, for closing remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. As explained throughout the presentation, we remain positive on Mexico fundamentals, despite the volatility that we may experience. As we said, we performed our needs for this year in anticipation to the volatility and along with our very prudent risk management approach. Thank you all and see you on the next conference call for the first quarter results.